This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, here we are, another week gone by, another Fed meeting, and ta-da-da, no interest rate hike this time. This reminds me of all the times we went through this last year, where we had no Fed rate hike until they finally got to the end of the year. Also, if you notice, Jim, the Fed is ratcheting down its forecast for economic growth. It's interesting how often they get this wrong, by the way. And especially with that, the Fed's ability to raise interest rates, when you realize that Janet Yellen is trying to get wiggle room in here in order to, if we have another recession like you're forecasting we're going to turn down into next year, she wants the wiggle room to be able to drop the rates to stimulate it. But they're out of that wiggle room, it seems like.
You know what was really interesting? And to me, I think this was probably the most significant Fed meeting that we've had in a long time, because really what the Fed was admitting here were two things. Number one, they're finally wrapping their arms around this idea that under the new normal, 1% and 2% economic growth rates are going to be more the norm versus, John, over the last 7 years, they always forecast, well, we'll get 3% economic growth. And then they didn't get it in the first half. And they said, well, in the second half, it'll pick up. And now we've had this economic pattern in this economic recovery, where in the second and third quarter, economic growth picks up, and then it starts to slow down in the fourth quarter and the first quarter. That has been the pattern for these last 7 years. And every time the economy would start to pick up in the second and third quarter, they would always say, okay, we're still sticking to that 3% economic forecast. John, we've never been able to hit it. The Obama economy is cruising at 2% at best. And what I thought was rather significant, for the first time, she admitted in the press conference, well, really under the new normal, and she mentioned that term, that really 2% economic growth is more likely the economic projections at which this economy will grow under the best circumstances. So there are a couple significant things. Number one, they lowered their interest rate projections for between 2016 and 2018 rather significantly. And that's really the Fed's admission that under these economic growth rates, there's just no way that we're going to be able to raise rates like we thought. So that was number one. Number two, they finally said 2% is their economic forecast for this year, because back as far as the March meeting, they were still projecting that we were going to hit 2.4% this year, which means that every single quarter for the rest of the year, especially after the weak first quarter, that we would have to be growing this economy at 2.7%. And the economic numbers, I don't care if you're looking at the LEI, we got industrial production that was down this week, whether we were looking at the job growth, which has been falling, or we're looking at any of the manufacturing side, which is weak, there's just no evidence that we're going to get these kind of growth rates. And I think this was the first meeting in 7 years when they finally said, you know what, 2% is as good as it's going to get. Now, what I thought was rather significant, now remember, we started out towards last year, the projections for the Fed funds rate this year was 2.5%. Then in December, when they raised rates a quarter of a point, their projection was for the Fed funds rate to hit 1 3/8, or let's just round it off and say 1.4%, which would have implied that they would be raising interest rates every quarter. Now, they threw that out the window in the March meeting. In this meeting, there's still that implication, well, maybe we'll raise it twice, but the projections for this year are 7/8, 2 rate moves in 2016. And John, let's go to that clip where she basically said, you know, under the new normal, the neutral rate is going to be much, much lower.
We have good reason to believe that the so-called neutral rate, or rate compatible with the economy operating at full employment, is low at the present time. And many of us believe, as a base case, it's reasonable to assume that those rates will move up over time. But we're not certain of that. It's one of the uncertainties that, and there could be revisions in either direction, but thus far, in recent SEPs, I'd say the revisions have mainly been in the downward direction. The idea that a low neutral rate may be more closer to the new normal, but you still do see some reversion. So we're really quite uncertain about that.
So there you have the Fed chairman saying, look, in the way things are going under this new normal, lower rates, lower economic rates are just going to be part of the environment. And I think, John, this is finally the Fed's own admission that, you know what, we're just not going to be able to do what we think they're going to want to do. Now, barring that comment, over the next couple of years, every chance that they can get, they're going to try to raise interest rates because they really would like to get the Fed funds rate up to 3% by 2018. I don't think they're going to be able to do it. I interviewed Dr. Gary Shilling this week, and his projection is they're more likely to talk about lowering rates or quantitative easing, given the weak economic circumstances we find ourselves in. And we'll get into not only the probability of recession, but a number of things that are out there that could cause some shocks that could bring about the next recession. What I find rather interesting, the futures market after this meeting has a 50% probability that we actually see no rate hikes at all this year. In other words, if we continue to see the job market begin to weaken, as we've seen since the last 3 months, if you take a look at the number of jobs created, we've already spent a lot of time talking about that. But if we're seeing this, imagine the kind of information the Fed is seeing. So the futures market is already saying there's a 50% probability we see no rate hikes at all. And if that's the case, it's because we're heading into an economic downturn, in which case the Fed is going to have to start preparing the market like, okay, we only raised interest rates a quarter of a point. Now, would that be something that in an economy that went through a recovery, the best the Fed could do was raise interest rates a quarter of a point? That just goes to show and tell you the circumstances that we find ourselves in.
But you know, Jim, six of the Fed governors are dissenting from what Chair Yellen is saying. They, as a matter of fact, think that there's only going to be a one-time raise during some time this year. If you look at it, you understand that the purpose of the Fed, aside from being the central bank, is to maintain expectations, all right? It's a lot of PR here because there's a lot of psychology and what happens with the economy. But if you notice, they're always saying that the economy is going to grow and then they'll raise rates. And of course, then they have to say, whoops, it just didn't do that. We're data dependent and it didn't make it. And so we're going to have to change our plan. In reality, this seems to be a credibility rescue because if you notice, they keep getting it, or at least Janet Yellen keeps getting it wrong.
Well, you know, in fairness to Yellen, her predecessor, Ben Bernanke, got it wrong 90% of the time. Right before the housing crisis hit, he was interviewed on television and he said that the housing market was in great shape. And of course, we got the first major decline in housing where prices fell 40%. So I think this was a little bit of admission trying to salvage some credibility. I mean, how many times can you start out the year with the forecast saying this is economic growth rate, this is what we plan to raise interest rates, and then every quarter you have to ratchet that down, both your economic forecast and how many times you plan on raising interest rates. What was interesting is when you consider when they started the taper, which was in May of 2014 when they announced it, and they began it in the fall, John, we were supposed to be at a Fed funds rate of over 3% in 2016, and here we are, and at best, we're going to be at maybe 7/8 by the end of the year. And what was interesting is after this meeting in the press conference and the accompanying notes, they don't expect to get the Fed funds rate up to 3% until well after 2018. I don't think they're going to get it that far. I think that there's going to be a recession and they'll be talking about doing something else like quantitative easing, because what else are you going to do when you only have the Fed funds rate at 0.5%? Let's go to John, those clips where she talked about the headwinds that have kept the Fed from raising rates, whether it's weakness here in our economy or problems overseas and also slow job growth, are really keeping the Fed at bay here.
To the extent that there are headwinds, I think many of us expect that these headwinds would gradually diminish over time, and that's a reason why you see the upward path for rates. But there are also more long-lasting or persistent factors that may be at work that are holding down the longer-run level of neutral rates. For example, slow productivity growth, which is not just a U.S. phenomenon, but a global phenomenon. You know, obviously, there is a lot of uncertainty about what will happen to productivity growth, but productivity growth could stay long for a prolonged time. And we have in aging societies in many parts of the world that could depress this neutral rate. And I think all of us are involved in a process of constantly reevaluating where is that neutral rate going, and I think what you see is a downward shift in that assessment over time, the sense that maybe more of what's causing this neutral rate to be low are factors that are not going to be rapidly disappearing, but will be part of the new normal. The likely pace of job gains is probably going to slow down somewhat. And we have seen some slowing, but the recent couple of months was very low and arguably not even at the pace we need to see to maintain stable labor market conditions.
You know, it was interesting that she was talking about these global headwinds, which are likely to persist and not go away. And I want to shift our conversation away from the U.S., John, because the very same things that we're seeing here that are preventing the Fed from, let's say, acting more aggressively, whether it's weak economic growth overseas, the dollar that rose from 2014, or economic growth rates that have been downgraded, what we're seeing here in the U.S., magnify it, it's global. And actually, it's much worse overseas than what we're seeing here. In fact, we talked last week on the program where the World Bank downgraded world economic growth from 2.9% down to 2.4. So even global authorities, not just the Fed, every entity from the IMF to the World Bank have been consistently ratcheting down economic growth rates. And like the Fed, the World Bank, the IMF have been making the same kind of large projections, economic growth rates of 3 and 4% overseas and globally. And, John, those growth rates just aren't being realized. So I want to shift gears and kind of put this into perspective why we're seeing these changes. And this gets back to if you're a premium channel member, I did a series of interviews with my good friend, Dr. Gary Schilling, and he wrote a book back in 2010. In fact, it's been updated in 2012, and I'd recommend if you really want to get a grasp on what's going on here and globally, you pick up a copy. It's called The Age of Deleveraging. Now, give you a little background about Schilling. I first met Gary in early, I think it was 1983 or 84. And when I got in this business, I came in this business in 1980, and you got to remember what it was like back then. We were experiencing 14.5% inflation. That was the CPI. Oil prices had gone from the beginning of the 70s around $2 a barrel. In 1980, they were 40. We had the Iranian Revolution. We had gold prices that were heading to 850. We had silver at $50. The only way you were making money in the financial markets is you had to be in hard assets. You had to be in real estate. You had to be in oil, gold, precious metals, gemstones, real estate limited partnerships. That was pretty much the investment portfolio that the financial industry was recommending to its customers when I got in the business. And, of course, oil peaked. We had Ronald Reagan become president of the United States and began to change the economy and fiscal policy to promote growth for once instead of stagflation. We had Paul Volcker at the Fed raising interest rates and bringing down the inflation rate. So there was a change that was taking place both in the economy and the financial markets. And I think it was 1982, Schilling wrote a book called Deflation, Ready or Not. And it was a real game changer for me, because when I read his economic rationale, it started to make sense on what we were seeing happen politically, both with what Volcker was doing at the Fed and then also what Reagan was doing with tax cuts and creating growth in the economy. So all that played out. And for the first 10 years of my investment career, I was basically a bond broker, because nobody wanted to invest in the stock market. It had done terribly in the previous decade, and people were making money in hard assets. Now, if you were, let's say, a retiree, you just retired, why in the heck would you want to be in the stock market when, you know, 10-year treasury bonds were over 15%? You could have got 14, 15% in government Ginnie Mae's. You got 12, 13, 14% of Vegematic and a toaster at a bank. And, I mean, we were even using annuities back then with the tax laws where you could get 12% and not pay tax on almost 80% of your monthly income. So there were a lot of things that were happening in the economy that were changing, and Schilling picked up on that. So it was rather interesting, after the financial crisis, he wrote a book called The Age of Deleveraging, and he described several things that were happening. Number one, he said, the best that we're going to get is 2% economic growth. We're going to see slow growth for almost a whole decade. Folks, what have we seen these last 8 years? He's been spot on. He also talked about deflationary forces hitting the economy, and we've seen that with commodity prices. And I can remember last year when he made a prediction that we would see $20 oil. Now, we got down to 26. When he first said that, I thought he was a little bit crazy, because oil had come down from $110 a barrel. It came down to 60 and 70. I thought that was about it. There's no way it was going down to 20. Nobody can make any money at that level. But sure enough, in February, we had gold prices below 1100 and we had oil prices at $26. Now, recently, I caught up with Gary on Thursday this week. We had a little bit of some audio difficulties, but I think you'll be able to hear, because one of the things that he said in his book, he said that the process of deleveraging would last for an entire decade. We're 8 years into it. More recently, Gary thinks that the process of deleveraging could last another 6 to 8 years. We're going to play a clip of why he thinks the age of deleveraging is going to extend much longer than we thought. Maybe not as long as Japan, but longer and well beyond a decade.
If you simply look at the rate in which the deleveraging has taken place so far, it could actually take another 6 or 8 years. Now, that's just putting a ruler on France. I mean, for example, consumer debt in this country, household debt from credit cards, student loans, auto loans, almost anything that's legal in relation to asset to after-tax income, which is normally how you look at it, that was the norm of 65%, that ratio, that's the income. In the early 80s, it took off, it got up to 130%, it now is down to 104%. But it's a long way from that norm. And as I say, if you just project where we are, it could take another 6 or 8 years.
That was from Jim's interview with Dr. Gary Schilling. And what he's saying here is that we're 8 years into this deleveraging process, but surprise, surprise, we probably have another 6 to 8 years to go, meaning approximately 16 years all told. And that's quite a bit.
Well, it's not only quite a bit, but I mean, look at what we're seeing. Last week, we talked about the lowest interest rates in recorded human history, where we actually saw negative interest rates. And then, of course, this week, the Fed's own admission that, you know what, forget the 3% growth rates, forget how much we're going to be able to raise interest rates. That's just not the world we live in. So after 7 years of this, the Fed is finally realizing, as are international institutions, that this new normal, this is what it is. The best you're going to get is 1% economic growth, as they're getting in Europe. You know, at least we get 2%, which is twice what they're getting in Europe. Europe would be happy with 1%. Japan has been happy, as Gary said, with 1%. And John, just look at interest rates this week. We got the 10-year treasury note down to 1.5%. Canada's 10-year note is down to 1.1. German 10-year bonds are actually negative. UK historic levels down to 1.1. France is 0.4%. Remember the pig country crisis when we were getting 8, 9%? Greece was 30%. Well, Italy is down to 1.5, almost equivalent to a treasury. Spain is down to 1.59. If you're in Switzerland, it's a negative 0.6%, almost like the 1970s. Japan is negative 2.1. And it was interesting because I interviewed Gary on Thursday, which was day after the Fed meeting. And I said, Gary, you know, what's your projection? I mean, do you think the Fed is going to be raising interest rates? Will we have one or two rate hikes? And will they be able to get to that 3% growth or Fed funds rate? Let's listen to what he had to say.
Yeah, I've been on record. I said this in our inside newsletter early in the year that I thought the next move of the Fed would be to cut rates, not to increase them. If it's increased rates, 25 basis points, a quarter of a point last December. And I think that was because they've been crying wolf so long, their credibility was disappearing. They've been talking about a stronger economy. They've been starting off 4% real growth year after year after year. Then they crank it down to reality, 2%. They've been looking for revival of inflation, and it's going the other way. And as a result, they've been forecasting that they would raise rates. I mean, you know, if you go back a couple of months, they in effect said they're going to raise rates 4 times this year. Now it looks like they may raise them once or maybe not at all. But anyway, their credibility was shot, and I think that's the only reason they raised rates in December. But now, as I look around, labor markets are certainly weak. The latest numbers for last month were extremely low, 38,000 payroll employment. That's a long way from the sort of 200,000 average, which has been too big to begin with. And the unemployment rate dropped from 5% to 4.7%, but that was only because people dropped out of the labor force. They gave up. They quit working for jobs. There were fewer people who, in effect, were counted as unemployed because they just weren't actively looking for work. So we've got a situation now where labor markets are weak and inflation is low, if not going into deflation. And then the Fed is now paying a lot more attention to the rest of the world. The slowing growth in China, you've got the Brexit situation in the UK, of course, whether they're going to leave the European Union or not. It's all factors that I think are convincing the Fed that they ought to, if anything, cut rates, but certainly not increase them.
Dr. Shiller is saying that they're more likely to cut rates rather than raise them. And, you know, even though, and but you have to look at this, what do we call it? Not a dichotomy, but rather a dissonance here, is that even though the economic growth rates have not been as predicted, it looks like 1% to 2% is going to be the new normal. Nevertheless, the Fed is insisting that they're going to raise rates, which lets you think that they're somewhat out of touch with what's going on. And ironically, the futures market has been much more accurate in its predictions, and the futures market believes they don't go at all this year.
Yeah, it's rather interesting because, John, we're following almost the same pattern exactly as we did last year, where we started out, we were going to have all these rate hikes, four rate hikes, or a couple rate hikes starting in June. That was postponed. September, that was postponed. And finally, they went in December. Here we are. Half of the year is over. It's unlikely they're going to raise rates in July, and it doesn't look like September. So if they go at all, especially with the presidential election in a weakening economy heading towards recession, that they're even going to go in December. But they want to reload the chambers because they know we're going to have another financial crisis. We're going to have another recession. And it's like, okay, we know this is coming. What are we going to do when the next crisis or financial crisis arises? What are we going to do to combat it? So if anything, it's going to be the balance of this decade before they can get interest rates anywhere near where they think. And I don't think it's going to be 3%. I think 2% is the best they're going to get. And let's face it, it's the first recovery in 7 years under any president that we have never seen a 3% growth rate. It is, and not only that, what the Fed is able to do is losing its efficacy in terms of the results. I mean, we saw this in Japan when they announced negative interest rates in February. Instead of stimulating the economy, people started hoarding cash, buying safes, and buying gold, which is one of the reasons why you're seeing the gold market so strong.
But if you notice, Janet Yellen remarked in the interview where she said they were going to have difficulty. Nevertheless, this has effects globally because the dollar still remains the world's reserve currency. So it's not just the U.S. that's affected here. Any move on their part affects everything worldwide.
You're absolutely right. What we have here is this sort of policy feedback loop with the Fed. it's not just that they're raising rates or they say they're going to raise rates. It has implications globally. And what happens is when the Fed starts talking about raising rates, or if they actually do, like they did in December, it triggers a chain of events. The first thing you see is they raise rates, given that the rest of the world is loosening and printing money, the dollar begins to appreciate. When that happens, credit spreads begin to widen between sovereign debt and corporate debt. We saw that last year, especially in the fourth quarter. The stock market begins to fall and correct, as we saw in September and October, in the beginning of the year. The VIX rises because now we're seeing volatility come into the market, and the yield curve flattens. Just like when they began to back off raising rates in February when Yellen was on Capitol Hill and Japan went to negative rates, there is the opposite effect. What happens? The dollar depreciates, which is what we've seen. Credit spreads tighten, meaning the spread on corporate bonds and sovereign debt begins to narrow, which has happened. The VIX falls, which it has. Stocks rise, and the yield curve steepens. And we're sort of in between right now, and that's why I think this meeting was rather significant. And there's been some negative effects here because the global markets are worried about what happens with Brexit, what happens if Britain withdraws. And of course, we saw a member of parliament killed this week, and the assailant blurted out the words, Britain first. And so we've got turmoil in the international markets with one country possibly leaving the euro. So that could be a crisis. We've got weakening economic growth. And all of a sudden, the stock market, instead of acting positive as it did, in other words, okay, the Fed is backing off. It's becoming more dovish than it is hawkish. But then the implications of that was the Fed's own admission. Hey, we're not going to have the economic growth rate. We thought 2% is the best we're going to get, and we're not going to be able to raise rates. And that's why, John, globally, we've seen it in Japan, and we're also seeing it here. The Fed is losing its ability to impact the markets. I mean, they can impact the markets. I mean, they could seriously create a financial crisis if they were to persist and just say, hell's bells, we're going to raise rates whether you like it or not, or the market. They could precipitate a global economic crisis. They still have the ability to do that. But in terms of their ability to influence the economy and financial markets, that's lessening more and more as the markets and participants begin to realize, hey, these guys really don't have a major control over the financial markets and economic growth.
And coming up next, what does all this mean for investors? Because is the situation hopeless, so to speak, where you're not going to be able to get very much? Or can you formulate some kind of a plan that will get you through it all? More of that on The Big Picture as we continue with the Financial Sense NewsHour at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at FinancialSense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Joining us on the show today is Tyler Kling. He's the co-founder of MacroOps, a global macro research and education firm. And Tyler, I'm excited to bring you on the show today because we're going to talk about the 60-40 classic stock bond portfolio, 60% equities, 40% in bonds, and some of the asymmetrical risks that you see facing investors moving forward given the long-term trends at play. But before we do that, I want to ask you about MacroOps and your sit rep reports, if I got that correct. A lot of military terminology. What's the framework for macro ops and how did you come about that name?
So macro ops, originally was named because of my other business partner, Alex, and he has an extensive background in the military. He started off as a Marine Scout sniper directly out of high school, and then he had a long military career and transferred into intelligence. And we really liked that because the people in that industry have a very mechanical and surgical approach to the stuff that they do. And we feel like that carried over well to the markets. You know, that's something that has to be taken really seriously, investing in trading, you know, as seriously as those guys in spec ops community take on their job. So that's kind of why we made macro ops sort of military themed. And that SITREP comes from what's called the situation reports that these spec ops guys get before a mission. So it's almost like a briefing where they go in and they explain, you know, what's kind of going on in the mission ahead and you know, what to do. And that's the same thing that we do with the SITREP. So that's why the military theme kind of came to be. It's more of a thing from Alex's background, but I really do think it carries well over to markets and approaching markets in the systematic surgical method that's needed to succeed.
In the last part of the big picture, we discussed monetary policy and the sort of new environment that we are in right now. It's been a transition into a new paradigm. Welcome back to the second part of the big picture on the Financial Sense News Hour. And now the question is, what does all of this mean as far as investment implications? Most of the technicians we have here on the program, Jim, are saying that, you know, we get to the 2100 level and then it falls back off again. And this seems to be a repeated pattern. And in reality, the market hasn't gone anywhere since 2014. And that's when the taper ended. So without Fed money printing, what does this all mean? Because just when you think they can't go lower, we're looking more and more are going into negative rate territory globally and falling treasuries here in the United States.
You know, it's amazing because, what was it, 2 weeks ago, John, we did a show on probably some of the most historic low interest rates we have seen in recorded human history. And I talked about, for example, British gilts are the lowest they've been since the Bank of England was founded in 1694. Just when you think they've gone the lowest that you've seen, they get actually lower. As we talked about this week, you have negative rates now in Germany. You have negative rates in Switzerland, negative rates in Japan. And who would have thought after the pig crisis, you would see rates in Italy and Spain lower than U.S. Treasuries. And it was interesting because in my interview with Schilling, I can remember interviewing him last year, and he made the prediction that Treasuries could get down to 1%. So when I caught up with him this week, I said, Gary, at the time we were doing the interview, which was on Thursday, Treasury yields got down to 1.54. I said, Gary, do you think we're heading to 1%? Let's play that clip where he talks about he still believes there's a strong case for 10-year Treasuries getting down to 1%. Do you realize, folks, what that is going to do to bond yields? And it's one of the reasons I think that you're seeing the stock market propped up for as long as it is. It hasn't made much headway, but we haven't had any crashes because where else are you going to go? You're going to go into cash at negative rates? Are you going to go into bonds at negative rates? Think what this means if you're a creditor. I mean, we've seen the lowest mortgage rates that we have seen in history. So if you're a debtor, it's a great time to go out and buy a home, which is one reason the housing market has been this strong, because you're getting 30-year mortgages in the 3% range. We saw that during the crazy real estate bubble of the last decade, but they were artificial. Now you can get long-term fixed rates in the 3% range, John. I mean, who would have thought if you and I were talking 10, 15 years ago, you and I would be talking about negative interest rates, zero interest rate, or 3% mortgages. It is absolutely incredible.
Well, I certainly do, and there are several factors. One is that treasuries have a tremendous safe haven appeal. Foreigners, when times are tough, they go to treasuries. You know, and ironically, if Trump were elected president, that might be very good for treasuries because it creates so much uncertainty to risk on, and people would ironically go for the safe haven, the dollar and treasury. But that's one factor. The second factor is that we have virtually no inflation and high probability of actual panic inflation in the economy, by my judgment. And a third interesting factor is that treasury yields, low as they are much higher than those of almost any other developed country. I mean, you look now at Germany, 10 years, they're negative. Japan, they're negative. I mean, we're 1.5. Hey, that's a high rate, and so forth. European investors or Japanese investors, they basically can invest in treasury and pick up a yield spread. And if the dollar rallies, I think it will, they get a double whammy because they get, in effect, more yen or more euros if their investments are in dollars, and they translate that back to their own currency.
You know, in his book, The Age of Deleveraging, Gary Schilling's describing all of this, but I guess what I'm trying to wrap my head around right now is, what does this mean? Because this is becoming a global phenomenon.
Well, I mean, if you take a look at what he describes, he goes, look, there's so much debt out there, very much like what we had at the end of World War II. And when you have debt, it has to be inflated away. That's the purpose of financial repression. So the implications are you're going to see economic growth slowing globally. And it's rather interesting to see this play out in our political presidential campaign, because you got Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton on the left, and it's saying it's rich people and we need more socialism to make the economy grow, which would actually destroy it. Just look at what's going on and what went on in Argentina. It was something that Gary pointed out in his recent newsletter. It's hard to believe that at one time, Argentina, at the beginning of the 20th century, was one of the most wealthiest nations in the world. Today, they're a basket case, just as socialism is just tearing apart the fabric of Venezuela and collapsing the economy. They may have a revolution there. So economic growth is slowing, not just here in developed countries like the U.S., Europe, and Japan, but it's also going globally. And the problem is the politicians versus reality. Politicians are telling you the opposite. And that's, John, the real risk here is you could see a major policy mistake. I mean, what if Clinton comes in, let's say she's the next president of the United States, and she raises tax rates to over 50% at a time when the economy is heading into recession, raises more regulation? John, we could make the same mistakes that the Fed and Roosevelt made in 1937 when we were trying to work our way out of the Great Depression. It was interesting because this week I was watching a Ken Burns series on Netflix called The Roosevelts, and they were talking about the economic recovery that began under FDR. He brought the unemployment rate down from around 25% down to around 15%, and then they thought they had done a good job. The stock market was up over 300%. The economy was growing at 7 and 8% a year, and inflation started to rise, and then they said, uh-oh, we got too much inflation. The deficits have gotten too big. We're going to change things, and the Fed ratcheted up interest rates. Roosevelt raised tax rates to 9% and basically just choked, killed the economy, and put it into another depression, which we did not come out of until the beginning of World War II. So the real risk here is major policy mistakes coming from politicians applying the wrong medicine. Remember back in the 17th century, John, when somebody got sick, they actually thought the way to cure them was to bleed the patient, which we know in most cases ended up killing the patient. And that's what you can have here, is politicians in their economic policies could come in, choke off and kill the economy with bad economic policies. Because the real problem here that nobody seems to grasp, whether it's the central bank or our politicians and some on Wall Street, the real problem here is leverage. Debt is the real problem. And that is the one thing that I really talked to him about. One of the first questions I asked was, in this age of deleveraging, what brought it about? And he talked about, we have too much debt and you have to work that debt off. Now, if you're listening to this program, just think of yourself. If you had a lot of mortgage debt, you were upside down in your mortgage. Let's say your mortgage was actually greater than the value of your house after the Great Recession. Or if you had piled up home equity loans, a lot of charge cards, it didn't matter what the interest rate was. Nobody would loan you money. And banks are stiffening their credit standards right now because banks are sensing the economy is slowing down. So they're getting very cautious right now because they could get fined and penalized by the government. And so banks are even seeing this. So, you know, here's what we're dealing with. Is now, I think you're beginning to see finally, this week with the Federal Reserve, last week with the World Bank, is our large financial government institutions are coming to grips with what we call the new normal or the age of deleveraging, when 1% and 2% economic growth is the new normal. And we're getting, as some claim, because you're starting to see inflation heat up now as energy prices start to rise, is some have described it stagnation. One of the proponents of stagnation is former Secretary of the Treasury, Lawrence Summers, who has talked about stagnation. Now, I asked Gary if he bought the idea of stagnation. Is that what we're likely to see going forward and for the balance of this decade and the next? Let's hear what he had to say.
I think it is interesting that the Fed is finally, after really about 6 years of over-forecasting economic growth, that they have cranked it down, and as you say, they're suggesting this may be the way life is going to be. They've also been reducing their expectations for future inflation and future rate increases. So, but I'm going to say this about the Fed. If I had a forecasting record that was that far off the market for so many years, I think I'd give up.
You know, the item we've witnessed, if we look around the world, and I was having a debate with a gentleman about this the other day, Europe made its turn a while back into more and more socialism with social programs and everything else like that. But we look at it, it has less economic growth now and much higher unemployment, especially among young people that are unemployed. Socialism has literally torn apart the economies of what? Argentina, Brazil has always flirted with it. Now look at Venezuela. It is a wreck. And you realize how prosperous it was before the arrival of Hugo Chavez and then his successor, Nicolas Maduro. And having talked with someone who's monitoring this situation, he says, you need to realize the government no longer cares about the people. It only cares about itself and keeping its own prerogatives going. So even though that we see these examples one after the other, where as you begin to introduce the socialistic idea, the economy slows down, unemployment goes up, there are monetary problems. And then finally, if you let it go to its nth degree, this wreckage. But the politicians still want to raise taxes, still want to promise goodies to people because that's how they put themselves in office. So there's a real split here. There's a dichotomy.
Well, there's not like a dichotomy, but in his recent Insight newsletter in June, Gary did something called the S-curve, which is the development of countries as they progress from an agricultural society to an industrial to a service economy. And he talked about areas of problems. Corruption in Africa has kept those countries in poor economic straits. He talked about socialism in Argentina and Venezuela. And then I brought up the issue to Gary and I said, well, what about, you know, take a look at this year's presidential campaign. You've got Trump wanting to go to trade wars and isolationism, and then you've got Sanders and Clinton talking about socialism. And I said, is there a risk that we could actually see socialism here in the United States, which would destroy our economy? So let's go to that clip and get Gary's views on socialism coming to the U.S.
You know, we did an interesting study years ago that we've updated periodically, and we looked at how many people receive a major chunk of income from government at some level. Enough that they would squawk if it were removed. We looked at, for example, government employees and their dependents, military people, people on Social Security, Medicare. You know, we counted, we think, pretty much everybody. Now, there's some things you exclude, like everybody's kids get subsidized milk money at school. We just continue that because most people don't even know it. But anyway, the interesting point is, if you go back to 1960, 36% of the population, in effect, had major help from government at some level. By the 70s, that actually got over 50%. It's now in the high 50s, and our estimates are it'll go to about 65% with the retiring post-war babies, growing Social Security, Medicare. Now, here's the reason I mentioned this. When that reached 50% back in the 70s, you could say, hey, if over half the population are supported substantially by government in some level, why don't they just go Sweden? Why don't they just vote themselves a completely socialist kind of environment? Redistribute income, soak the rich, however you want to phrase it. But they didn't. And I think it tells me that there's something in American character that people really feel that they're going to get further ahead on their own in a free market environment than they are if they concentrate on income redistribution. Now, there are plenty of people who are for income redistribution. That's pretty much the Sanders approach, and Hillary isn't too far behind. But I don't think that that is a dominant belief in America, and we've got this history that suggests it isn't.
You know, it's amazing if you look at it, though, although this seems to be the way things go historically, now that we have the Federal Reserve here in the U.S. and the World Bank, gradually coming to grips with the reality of this age of deleveraging as being the new normal. Perceptions change slowly. Okay, right now, it's taken, what, 8 years for them to recognize that things have actually changed. And that's really true of any major paradigm shift. You know, most of the time when people go through a paradigm shift, they think, oh, this is just a fluke from the normal, and with just a little work, we can get back to what it used to be. And then the next step seems to be, well, they recognize, all right, something has changed, but we'll just apply the old rules to the new situation. And finally, they get to stage three, where they realize not only has it changed, but new rules apply. And that's, I think, what you're witnessing here.
Yeah, and it's amazing, but once again, the wrong prescriptions are being applied. And it's kind of like, well, we did all this stuff and it didn't work. I mean, the Fed has done QE 1, 2, 3, and 4. We've got negative interest rates. It's not working, John. And they're coming to the realization that, you know, with all these debt levels out there, that you're just not going to see the 3% economic growth. And we've had the worst fiscal policy the last 8 years in the U.S., which have been a disaster. And it's one of the reasons why we're pretty confident we're heading into a recession, which we'll get into here shortly. But they're not recognizing and applying the right fiscal policies, very much like what Reagan did to bring us out of that hyperinflationary period of the 1970s. The combination of Reagan and the combination of good monetary policy under Volcker finally brought us out of that and created almost two decades of prosperity. They haven't come to that realization because the economic thought process is really controlled by the media today. I call them the government media because they just echo whatever comes out of the White House. And we're not dealing with the realities. And that's why I think that this age of deleveraging, as Schilling talked about, is likely to continue for another 6 to 8 years, which is not good news for investors or savers.
Well, I remember there was one point in the interview, Jim, where you asked Gary Schilling, what would bring us out of the age of deleveraging and then restore economic growth?
You know what? It's what brings us out of any deleveraging. That debt, the massive amount of debt that has been accumulated both at the corporate, the individual, and now the government level, has to get inflated away. And it's my prediction, John, whether it's Trump or Clinton, the next president will use the combination of fiscal policy, massive fiscal spending that will be monetized by the Fed, that will increase the rate of inflation to bring those levels down to more moderate level in nominal terms. But towards the end, what will actually start the next level of economic growth where we get back more towards normal economic growth rates, the inflating away of the debt and a technological revolution. I mean, you take a look at the world that we live in today. The things that we have that we take for granted, our iPods, our iPads, our iPhones, social media, to driverless cars, the things they're working on the drawing board. And this happened also, John, during the Great Depression. We were making great technological advances from radio to airplanes to television to the electrification of the country. I mean, think of the things we've been able to do with the internet, how that's changed commerce. I mean, we're just at the beginning, the revolution that's taking place in medical technology, where they're saying that, you know, kids born today may live to be 100. I have several clients that live in a retirement home, and I think there's 450 residents, as I recall. And one of the daughters of my clients, I was meeting with her, and she was telling me that in her mother's retirement home, out of that 450 or 500, there are 190 residents that are over the age of 90, and they have 10 residents over the age of 100. So expanded lifespan. So it's going to be another technological revolution. There are things on the drawing boards today that you can't even think of, or none of us are even aware of, that are going to be changing our life. I mean, in the next 10 years, I mean, we've set our house up with, it's solar powered now. It's a smart home. And we also have 220 outlets in our garage because I believe my next car will be an electric car, hopefully a more of a hybrid car with some gasoline. Because what do you do when your battery goes dead? And I think what you're going to see is instead of gas stations, eventually you'll see charging stations, or I think what they'll do is you'll pull into a station and they will just lift up the trunk, take out the batteries and replace new batteries and send you on your way. So it's going to be technology. But before that, we have to inflate away this debt. And that's why financial repression, where we see today over a third of the sovereign debt in this world is negative interest rates. You're getting nothing at the bank. We're seeing the lowest interest rates in 5,000 years of recorded history. That still has 6 to 8 years to play out.
Well, it seems, though, after we go through this, I mean, everything goes in cycles, but Gary Shilling seems to be pretty sanguine about the idea that once we come out of this, then we'll see an upturn in economic growth.
I think it'll be technology, and it's technologies that are actually well-known today. They're growing like Topsy, but they're not yet big enough to move the economy. Now, there are people, Bob Gordon, professor at Northwestern, is a noted example, who believe that everything that's worth being invented that can really move the productivity and economic growth needle has been invented. It's a modern Malthusian view. And by the way, it's very easy to sell, because when everybody looks around and says slow growth, anything that says slow growth forever, whether it's Gordon or whether it's Larry Summers for the secular stagnation, that sells. Everybody says, hey, I see that. It's an easy sell. But I think that we're going to see technologies. Now, the reason I say some of these technologies, robotics is certainly one, additive manufacturing, biotechnology. The reason I think that these are going to be driving the economy is not because they're brand new, but because they are going to get big enough to do the job. And I would point out a couple of historic examples where this was true. If you look at the Industrial Revolution, it started in England and New England in the late 1700s, growing fantastic rates, but it didn't get big enough in this country to have an impact on the economy until after the Civil War. The same was true of railroads. Railroads were invented in the late 1700s. And again, they were not substantial enough until after the Civil War, the latter half of the 1900s, that they started to provide tremendous economic growth. The same was true in the 1920s. The 20s were an explosive growth era, and the technologies there were really nothing new. They were just being developed and rolled out. Mass-produced automobiles, cars were invented in the late 1800s, but it was only with Henry Ford and mass production that they started to move the needle. And of course, you got the roads and hotels and everything with it. And the other thing was electrification of homes and factories. Edison electrified East Orange, New Jersey in the 1880s, but it was only in the 1920s that electrification of homes and factories became widespread enough that you got appliances and radio and all the things that were driven by it, and became a major force in economic growth. Those are the analogies that I use to suggest that technologies are going to drive growth, and they're already known. It isn't something that is yet to be invented. It's just they've got to continue to grow and get big enough to dominate the economy.
And so if we're assuming that we're going to move through this, at least we're looking at the fact that the Fed here seems to be coming to grips with the new normal, which implies lower economic growth. Okay, so we're going to have lower growth, lower interest rates. This will probably go on for the next 6 to 8 years. Now that you know that's the frame of where we most likely are, then the very obvious question is, what does this mean for investments?
You know, one of the things that we have to think about, even though this bull market, which began back in 2009, we've got stocks up over 200%. But John, this bull market has been driven by other factors than fundamentals. If we take a look at what happened when Bernanke brought interest rates down to zero and long-term interest rates came down to 3 or 4%, what we saw take place with corporations is the same thing you would do as a astute consumer. Companies, from utilities to corporations, refinance their debt. So if you were a utility and you had an 8% corporate bond, you were able to refinance that 8% corporate bond for 4%. So what did that do? It lowered your interest cost. It increased your profits. You saw companies increase their dividends. The other thing it did is it allowed for arbitrage in the markets. And we talked about this beginning in 2012 and 2013. You began to see companies from Intel to Apple tap into the debt markets, Apple getting a 5-year bond, less than 1.5%, Intel doing the same, Microsoft doing the same. I can remember Intel financing itself, getting $5 billion worth of bonds for 1.6%, and then turning around and buying back its stock, whose dividend at that time was over 4.25%. So you saw a lot of companies use the debt markets to raise debt, leverage their balance sheet, and buy back their stock and raise dividends. The problem is corporate profits peaked in the summer of 2014. And the economy peaked in the summer of 2015. So you can't have a peak in the economic cycle and they expect profits to increase. I mean, they've played the financial engineering game for as long as they can, but that has come to an end. Debt is going to get more expensive, and it's a lot of debt rating agencies are watching these companies and the amount of debt that they raise. So basically, financial engineering has run its course. So what are going to drive stock prices? The only thing that's going to drive stock prices is going to be higher top-line revenue growth, which has been absent in this economic recovery, and higher profits. Well, if the economy is slowing down and more likely to go into a recession, about the only thing that could drive stock prices higher would be a expansion of PE multiples. In other words, people are saying, you know what, I used to pay 12 times earnings, I'll pay you 16, 18, 20 times earnings. So you're just simply paying more for the same dollar of profits. But that would be the only thing that would drive stock prices higher in this kind of a market, because you now have the Fed, the World Bank saying we're not going to hit our economic growth targets. They're going to be much lower than we thought. And by the way, interest rates are going to remain lower.
We've talked a lot here on the program about being in favor of dividend stocks, and Robin Griffith was echoing much of the same thing. That's probably going to be one of the few places you can get some kind of a return like that.
It is. And for a while, I mean, you know, after World War II in the 50s and 60s, if you were a stock investor, stock dividends paid a higher dividend than bonds, just as they are now. It's amazing. You know, 35 years into my investment career, we are now seeing dividends higher than interest. And the main reason you bought stocks was for dividend yield. And John, I think that's going to return. And just as Gary Shilling talked about, the Shiller PE is historically high, which implies a lower rate of return for markets. In other words, a reversion to the mean in terms of stock market return. So the bulk of your return in the future, just as Robin Griffith talked about in the first hour, is mainly going to come from dividends that you receive from stocks and the interest that you receive on bonds, keeping some cash on the side. If you're going to get any growth and appreciation, it's probably more likely to come from asset markets like energy and gold. But I do think in the future, if you're a stock investor, you're going to have to ferret out those companies that are able to increase their top line growth in a world that is not growing at all. That's why you've seen, you know, the FANG stocks last year, investors were willing to pay these huge premiums for these companies that were able to increase their top line growth, because everywhere you looked elsewhere, there was no top line growth. If you looked at retailers, they weren't doing it. The only person that was growing their top line on retailing was Amazon. So, you know, if you're going to look for growth in the future, you're going to have to ferret out those companies that have the rare ability to increase their top line growth. And, you know, there's enough of those around. So if you're a good stock picker, that's why I think in this market, active management and stock picking is what's going to matter going forward, because indexing isn't working, as evidenced by what we've seen in the S&P since 2014. It's basically gone nowhere in the last 18 months. And others aren't as sanguine as I am. I still think you can get a decent return with short-term bonds and also on dividend-paying stocks of high-quality companies. When I asked Gary Shilling, I said, Gary, given your scenario of deleveraging lasting another 6 to 8 years, you're pretty much short on everything but long the dollar and long treasuries. Let's listen to that clip.
As you know, I started advocating treasuries back in 1981 when the 30-year treasury yield was 15.2%. I said back there that we're entering the bond rally of a lifetime, and the rates have fallen. Now they're down to 2.6% on 30-year treasuries, and that's been a tremendous play. As a matter of fact, since the early 80s, that decline in interest rates and the flip side, which is the increase in prices, have made treasuries outperform the S&P 500 by 6.5 times since then. Now, I think that that bond rally of a lifetime still has further to go. If I'm right that we go to 2% on the 30-year bond, there's probably another 15 or 20% yet to be made in that, and that could happen within the next year. So that's one thing. And to say, this has been an investment that I've been involved in personally and for clients, with clients' money that we manage, and of course, as a forecaster for 35 years, and I think it's still intact. So that's one thing that people should pay attention to. And most people don't understand the idea of buying treasuries for appreciation. They think you buy a 30-year treasury, you're going to get 2.5% yield for 30 years. Well, you know, that isn't the game. Who buys stocks for yield?
2% yield on the S&P 500. Most people buy stocks for appreciation. That's the reason I've always bought treasuries. I never bought them for yield. I want appreciation, which takes place as yields go down. So that's one thing. The other thing, I think, in this uncertain period, if people do feel that they want to be basically long stocks, and a lot of people have that kind of feeling, it's unpatriotic to do other than be long stocks. I think right now, having a very heavy cash position makes a lot of sense. I mean, stocks are not cheap. If you look at price-earnings ratios, and the one that we was put together by my friend Bob Shiller, Nobel Prize winner from Yale, and what it suggests, and he looks at PEs over the last 10-year basis, corrected for inflation, et cetera, and that would say that stocks are, relative to long-term trends, are about 45% overvalued right now. The other thing about stocks is that what is pushed earnings, you know, you have a PE and then you got to apply it to some earnings. The earnings in this expansion has not been solidly based on revenue growth. What you'd like to see is strong revenues, and then you subtract costs and you get to the bottom line, what's left. But that hasn't happened because of slow growth in the economy. Unit volume for corporations has been very low, very slow growth. And of course, with no inflation, and actually at the company level, at the producer level, we've had deflation in the last 3 or 4 years. They've had no pricing power, no ability to raise prices. So the revenue growth has not worked. And of course, revenues have undershot profits. Why? Because they've turned to cost cutting. And cutting costs has worked. But most costs ultimately are labor costs, and that adds to this lack of real income growth. But the point is that that huge expansion in the profit margin, which started in the depths of the recession, it pushed profit margins to all-time highs, but they leveled off about 2 years ago, and they've actually declined recently. And when I talk to industrial clients, and I say, what's going on in terms of cost-cutting productivity? Are you scraped the bottom of the barrel, or you pick out the low-hanging fruit, you have to wait for more to ripen? And they always claim there's more to be done, but for whatever reason, they're not getting much results right now. So I'm saying two things about stocks. One is PEs are very high, and secondly, earnings are not based solidly on revenue. They've been based on cost-cutting, and that does not appear to be working any longer. So for those two reasons, I think anybody who has a strong predilection to be long stocks ought to have an extremely high cash position.
Well, next year we have a recession in your forecast. Also, by the way, the full impact of Obamacare is going to hit when insurance premiums go up for the majority of Americans. That's after the elections, by the way. And now you have a situation that slowly but surely some people are, well, a lot of people have recognized it for some time, and that's radical Islam's war on the West. It's largely a war of terror, but the politicians seem really reluctant to tackle it in that mode. And of course, this has implications too, not just the terror war, but also what's going on with the various wars in the Middle East.
Well, it also has implications because, you know, as I talked before, when the economy is growing and economic growth is strong, it acts as a shock absorber to exogenous events. And we saw that in, let's say, 2011. We had Fukushima. We had the Arab Spring. We had the debt ceiling debate. We had the pig crisis. We had the downgrading of U.S. debt. And by the end of the year, the stock market was flat because the economy can absorb these shocks. But as economic growth weakens, as it is now doing, as the unemployment rate starts to rise, which I begin will start seeing because we're already seeing a major slowdown in job growth. That's the first signs. The economy has less of a cushion to absorb these shocks. And if you've noticed, John, over the last 8 years, the frequency and the magnitude of these attacks are increasing. They're becoming more frequent, and the death toll is getting larger in each attack. We had the head of the CIA in front of Congress this week and saying, you know what, prepare, more attacks are coming. We know this, and they could be even bigger and worse than what we just saw in Orlando this week. So we saw what happened last year in Paris. We just saw what happened in Orlando. And imagine these events. And remember, the gentleman that committed these terrorist attacks was also casing out Disney World. So you could see what happened in Paris happen here at either a sporting event like a football game, a basketball game, a baseball game, a rock concert, some large event. So the impact becomes larger and larger. And the one thing we know, they're becoming more frequent. And it's just absolutely amazing we're letting these people into the country. But nonetheless, it makes our economy and our markets very fragile because economic growth is slowing down. Eventually, it's contracting, and it wouldn't take much for a major event to push us over the edge, just as the events of 9/11 did back in 2001. So we're still staying with our cautious stance, as you heard Dr. Schilling say there. We're a little bit more sanguine about consumer staples, utilities, high dividend paying stocks, and short-term corporate bonds, I think, is a place you want to hide out, along with adding some gold.
All right, so what you have to grapple with here now is we're approaching the end of the era of economic growth. And that's going to go on for another 6 to 8 years. That's just where it stands. Probabilities of a recession, very, very high. We're going to be at historic low interest rates. And because of all of these things together, for people who are savers and investors, these are difficult times. And you have to invest and act accordingly. And on that dire note,
it's not that dire.
Well, I mean, theoretically, right? If you know what's going on, you can make money. You can make investments, right?
Yeah, it's just that the rate of returns that we were used to coming out of the recession where we had those years of double-digit returns, they're probably not going to be with us for a while.
Okay, so act accordingly. Anyway, well, the Fed met this month. We have another month coming up. One never knows. Anyway, anything else on the radar we should be looking forward towards?
We are now approaching the end of the second quarter in the first half of the year. So our attention in the next month and the next 6 weeks are going to be what is going on in corporate profits. Obviously, if you want stock prices to head higher, you've got to have the profits to back it up. Otherwise, why are investors going to pay more money to own a stock? So we're going to be paying attention to corporate earnings. What are companies saying about second quarter earnings? More importantly, what are they saying about Q3 and Q4 for the balance of the year? Because, you know, typically on Wall Street, the analysts start out the year and they're saying, okay, we think ABC company is going to make $1 a share, which means, let's say, a 25 cents per quarter. Well, in the first quarter, instead of 25 cents, they only made 20. In the second quarter, they only made 15 cents. Analysts tend to shift their focus and downgrade a little bit, but they shifted over the second half of the year. Well, what are analysts going to be doing if companies are saying, hey, we didn't make 25 cents in the first quarter, we didn't hit it again in the second quarter, and we're unlikely going to hit it in the third and fourth quarter? So watch what companies say, watch what earnings come in. I mean, right now they're downgrading earnings, and then we're playing the corporate earnings game. Companies will come in and they'll beat lower estimates. I mean, we're getting these estimates down so low, you don't even need a pole vault to jump over. You just walk over them. They're so low. So expect a lot of companies to beat estimates. But what we're going to be looking at is what is happening on the top line. Are these companies experiencing any revenue growth, which I doubt we're going to see? So corporate earnings will be on the agenda over the next 6 weeks. In the meantime, as always, we're out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.